This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. Today, we examine the benefits and risks of internet activism, which can be used to both topple tyrants and to disable dissidents. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The so-called Arab Spring of 2011 was a perfect storm of internet dissent, regime repression, human rights opportunities, superpower manipulation, democracy agitation, and internet intervention. Although some of Egypt's web activists were quietly groomed by the State Department's Alliance for Youth Movements, nevertheless, many brave locals used tweets and videos to summon rallies and garner international support, until the government simply turned off the web. Even today, the substitution of web clips for on-scene reporting and grassroots organizing suggests that the internet can be a double-edged sword. Just this week, it was revealed that some of the leading internet citizen journalists in Syria, whose dispatches are breathlessly repeated by American corporate media, actually faked some of their so-called reporting by lighting tires off-screen and pretending that the smoke was the result of government artillery fire. Moreover, the internet, with its digital fingerprinting and government monitoring, can also be used as a tool of surveillance and suppression, as well as one of limited liberation. The positive use of the web was extolled by a group of hacktivists in the new film about the group Anonymous, titled We Are Legion.
In kind of the lead up to the Egyptian revolution, we would tweet on people's behalf. We would get people from Egypt who were unable to access Twitter on their own on our IRC network, and we would take reports from them and tweet them out using our account to kind of help them get the word out about what they were experiencing.
Some of it is personal, and one of the things about the movement as a whole, when Egypt rolled around, is that Egypt broke us emotionally. Watching in real time with live feeds that we helped set up, Egyptians get massacred with machine guns. It was different, and I have never in cyber activism wept before. It's never bothered me like that. It's never been able to touch me the way Egypt touched me.
That these people had every right to freedom, that they had every right to choose their government.
And then January 27th, January 28th rolls around, and the Egyptian government starts shutting down the internet. I mean, just for the whole country. The whole country. There's this fantastic traffic graph that you can see the traffic coming out of Egypt, and it looks like, you know, like this. Just totally stops. To think that a country would completely cut itself off as much as it was able to from the outside world was pretty unthinkable. You know, we know bad things go on in the dark places.
That's the kind of thing that could start riots. I think when Mubarak did what he did, I think it really upset people here, as well as in the Middle East.
I put myself in their place, and I found myself in a desert of nothingness because he just wiped out everything that my world incorporated. That just showed me and everybody else that the same thing can happen at any time, at anywhere, in any government.
Anonymous and the people on the internet stood up and said, look out for yourself. You want to shut down their internet? Fine. The people on the internet will show them how to turn it back on.
On the other hand, Evgeny Morozov, the author of The Net Delusion, spoke recently at a conference titled The Power Media Revolution, Making the 21st Century. Morozov has a trenchant analysis of the risks of internet immersion by digital optimists.
I think they fail to understand that a lot of technologies that they celebrate can actually be put to oppressive ends and essentially be used to oppress people as much as they can liberate them. They also fail to understand that a lot of the current excitement about the liberating potential of the internet has not new at all. Similar waves of excitement took over mankind about the telegraph and the steam engine and the printing press and all others, very often those hopes did not come to pass, but often they also distracted policymakers and citizens from trying to articulate a future where those projects can actually be realized, right? Many of these technologies can be liberating. Many of them can help to democratize the world, but it will take a lot of effort. And I think cyber-utopianism, which often borders on techno-determinism, it kind of thinks and assumes that things will function automatically, that maybe we don't have to put the extra effort, we don't have to understand it in very fine detail, we can just talk all this nine talk about the internet changing everything, and it will continue forever. Well, it wouldn't. We'll have to put a lot of effort to preserve this potential.
Yes, I remember a nice tweet over the Tunisian revolution where someone said, I can't understand how the Tunisians overthrew their government without me changing my Twitter avatar or signing an e-petition. But let's focus on the issue of security. You're trying to be secure in relation to your friends, but the police who need to know will know anyway.
Well, I mean, yes, but that's a very defeatist attitude, I think. We have to articulate points of intervention. We have to work on very concrete, specific issues. The duration of data retention policies, the ways in which our social networking profiles will get integrated with latest facial recognition technologies, the way in which the rhetoric of cybersecurity and cyber threat is being invoked by technology companies to justify greater consulting gigs. There are lots of projects that can be scrutinized, debunked, challenged in public, and that will actually bring on some critical scrutiny, but also better policies. I don't entirely give up. Again, if you look at it from a very macro level view, where you just think about the internet or security and you don't want to unpack it into smaller disciplines, smaller technologies, smaller components, then things look hopeless. If you start disaggregating it into smaller chunks, whether it's privacy on social networking sites, whether it's the right to be forgotten, whether it's facial recognition technologies, I think there are points of intervention and there are actors and allies to be mobilized. I mean, there is no man out there, you know, the man with a capital M, that's, you know, the corporation or the government that's out there to get us. There are different alliances that can be exploited by activists to deliver the agenda that they're campaigning on. These powerful entities, they're not monolithic. And it's possible for activists to pit them against each other and actually, in the end, strategically gain ground that they otherwise wouldn't get. But I think the word openness very often conceals more than it reveals. What is openness? If I have a right to privacy, then I don't want openness at all. If I want my privacy to be defended, I actually want security. I want my data to be secure. So this Manichaean kind of, you know, theorizing where we put openness on the one side and then security on the other, I just refuse to accept it altogether because that presumes that there is this internet out there and that prizes openness and that somehow doesn't like security. And, you know, for me, human rights of people come first. And this is my starting point. I want people who can be secure, then the data will not be shared with others. And if it requires modifying the internet in one way or another, let's go for it. I'm all for it. Like, it's not a sacred cow, as it is for many campaigners.
Net Delusion author Evgeny Morozov speaking recently with Richard Herring of Vision on TV. The costs and benefits of internet activism were elaborated upon by Microsoft and Harvard researcher Dana Boyd at the just-concluded Webstock 12 conference in New Zealand. Boyd asserts that viral messaging can feed into a corporate-friendly climate of fear, easily manipulable by corporate sponsors and repressive regimes alike. She further contends that the so-called Arab Spring internet revolution in Egypt was a perfect example of the law of unintended consequences. While the Facebook world focused on web activists, fewer people noticed Egypt's majority population, who used face-to-face organizing to elect a majority fundamentalist legislature dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, thereby thwarting the favored candidates of international web activists.
Thank you so much for coming out today. So one of the things I love about coming to New Zealand is that I find that people are really open and warm and welcoming. So I decided to take a risk and write an entirely new talk of material that I haven't actually finished thinking through. My goal today is actually to try to entice you to have conversations with me because I need help in thinking through these ideas. My talk today actually rests on three, foundational claims and one critical question. The claims are that, one, we live in a culture of fear. Two, the attention economy provides a fertile ground for the culture of fear. And three, social media, the things that we are building, are amping up the attention economy. So my question is really simple. What hath we wrought? The goal of my talk today is to really explore what the role of social media is in perpetuating the culture of fear. My goal here is not to get into utopian or dystopian rhetorics, but to really try to critically interrogate what this means and what our responsibility is in light of this. Many of us are technologists and designers, pundits and users, and we are all part of this system in one way or another. So how do we actually think about our role and our position in many ways of power in this environment? In science technology studies, we like to talk a lot about, different things of how technology can be understood. And there's a really powerful maxim that came out, which is often jokingly called the Kranzberg's first law. And he argued that technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. And the reason I think that this is important is that I think that more often than not, we like to think that the systems that we are building are either positive or neutral, without actually seeing the complex and complicated ways in which it intersects. Many of the tools we built, we designed for geeks. We meant for our own community. But as these tools have gone mainstream, we have a really important responsibility to ask what that means. So the goal here today is to really go through some of these things and think with you. So to begin, let's talk about the culture of fear. Now, fear is an extraordinarily important emotion. It's a reasonable psychological response to any sort of trigger emotion, to uncertainty, to threat. It's a survival mechanism. It's what allows us to assess a risky situation and determine a reasonable response. And we learn how to be fearful of things based on our experience. But sometimes that can go terribly awry. And I like to tell the story of a friend of mine's dog. And the dog was very deeply distraught by the sound of the smoke detector. He thought that it was a terrible sound that was being made. And he realized that the smoke detector was somehow associated with the oven being opening. So therefore, he became afraid of the oven. The oven was a scary object. It opened, he went running. He then realized that somehow the oven only opened when the fridge opened. So he became afraid of the fridge. Then he quickly realized that whenever humans went into the kitchen, they seemed likely to open the fridge. Ergo, people entering in the kitchen were a terrible, terrible thing, and off he would go and run. Now, this kind of dog-like neuroses is kind of funny, and we like to laugh at the dog, but the fact is, as humans, we're terrible at risk assessment, and we do the same kind of neurotic things as my friend's dog. Over the years, countless books have been written about how people are terrible at actually assessing risk in their own life. Now, I study, first and foremost, youth culture. So let me tell you, my job is all about people panicking and fearful ideas of what's going on, especially about the internet and society and technology and, ooh, bad kids, So I often get approached by parents who really like to know, it's like, what should I be most afraid of? And I'm like, that's an odd question. And needless to say, what they want to hear is how Facebook is dooming society or why giving their kid a cell phone is a terrible thing. And they hate my response. And I said, well, statistically, the most damage that will happen to your kid will be as a result of he or she getting into the car with you. And parents sit there going, no. I'm in control of the car. I know how the car works. And this is the really logical response to a stimuli that you think you understand. No one wants to understand the risk that is the risky environment. Technology is the thing we don't understand. Therefore, technology is what we want to fear. But fear is not predicated on risk assessment. It's all about the perception of risk, and it's about how we negotiate that perception. We fear the things that we don't understand more than the things that we do, even when statistics show that that's ridiculous. We fear the unknown. Well, as the technologies that we're building are ramping up the possibility of unknown, guess what? People are getting fearful of the kinds of systems that we're building. They're fearful of the implications of it. Now, that means that fears only get worse, by the way, when you add insecurities or when we challenge our ability to be in control. So this is where parents who are already insecure about their role only get worse when they think about technology. Because when it comes to young people, we're afraid of them and we're afraid for them. And that fear really drives our perception of a lot of technology. Now, I spend a lot of time basically combating fear. In fact, I think my entire role in life is to basically scream that the kids are all right. But more often than not, I'm told about all of the terrible things, right? Bullying, pornography, file sharing, sexting, sexual predators. And what we see is the rise of moral panics. What's interesting to me is that moral panics are not new, but they're really ramped up in this environment. Now, it's impossible to combat fear with statistics. Trust me, I've tried. This works terribly. No matter how much you tell parents about the statistics of the things that go on with their kids, you tell them one bad story and they're convinced that this is going to happen to their kid tomorrow. This is precisely how fear gets people into a frenzy. It's extremely difficult to combat fear. It's extremely easy to ramp it up. And here's where we get to the notion of the culture of fear, which is different than fear itself. The culture of fear is the idea that fear can be employed by marketers, politicians, the media, and the public to really regulate the public, to give people a sense of what's going on such that they can be controlled. Fear isn't simply the product of natural forces. It can systematically be generated to entice, motivate, or suppress. It can be leveraged as a political tool, and those in power have long used fear for precisely these goals. Terrorism, for example, is the systematic use of fear to achieve a very political agenda. Now, interestingly, throughout the history of media, we have seen each genre of new media be leveraged for the production of fear. Right? Yellow journalism meant that newspapers became really saturated with scary headlines. The idea was to generate sales. The history of radio and television was very much sullied with propaganda as a way of generating popular attention and focus for political means. So the question is, why do we think that our media is any different? I would argue that our media is very much being used in a process of the culture of fear. But the question is how? So this brings me to my second claim. The attention economy provides a really fertile ground for the culture of fear. So in the 1970s, there was a political economist named Herbert Simon, and he argued that in an information-rich world, the wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a scarcity of whatever it is that that information consumes. What information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. His argument gives rise to the notion of the information overload, but also to the notion of the attention economy. In the attention economy, people's willingness to distribute their attention to various information stimuli create sort of panic in different ways. Indeed, the economic importance of advertisements is predicated on the notion that it's about getting people to pay attention and the idea that that has value. So we see this playing out more increasingly in social media. Social media brings quantities, massive quantities of information, unscripted, unedited, uncurated, and going online feels like you can swim in an ocean of information. The very notion of being able to consume everything is laughable. So what are you paying attention to in an environment of information overload? The amount of information is not something that you can deal with. So as a result, you have one of two responses. You can get super anxious, trying desperately to pay attention to more and more and more information, or you can do what Michael Bernstein, a computer scientist, calls going Twitter Zen, which is just accepting that there is information flowing over you, and you're only going to be able to see a very small fraction of that fire hose. But one thing's clear, information is constantly ramping up. And this is also something that is changing rapidly in our field in very quick order. You know, my brother and I were going through my mother's house and cleaning up, and we ran across a book that we bought in 1994. And it was a Yellow Pages for the Internet. And we burst out laughing looking at this because the goal of this book was to try to tell us every website that was on the internet, right? Which is really funny to think about in today's day and age, but it was a very serious book and it was a very serious attempt to catalog what was happening. It was taking an old model that was understood and bringing it into a digital environment. Yet today, the idea of being able to capture every website is crazy. So why do we think that we should be able to read every email or every tweet or every blog post? We can't, and it creates amazing amounts of anxiety. And yet our technologies continue to tell us that we have things that are unread. And it's like this unbelievable guilt that comes from the technology being like, you're a bad person, you didn't read everything. It's impossible to read even a fraction of what's out there at this point. So part of it is, how do you get people's attention in this environment? And this is where we see fear come out. The more there are stimuli competing for your attention, the more likely it is that fear is going to be the thing that will drive your attention to them. It becomes a game of psychological warfare, and indeed we're seeing a lot of social media marketing leverage this, desperate to get your attention in any way. Fear is extraordinarily effective. It's not the only emotion that can be leveraged, and in fact we see a whole variety of emotions being leveraged, but it's a very powerful one. And this is why I'd argue that the attention economy provides a very fertile soil for the culture. Now, if you pay attention to threatening stimuli, fear emerges. But at the same time, fear gets your attention. And this is the odd symbiotic relationship between fear and attention, right? They work together. We pay attention to emotion of fear because it helps us actually judge what's going on around us. And our willingness to pay attention to it is what allows it to actually operate. Now, fearmongers leverage this tendency in order to get us to pay attention to their content, their message. A fearful newspaper will capture people's attention through a scary headline. I certainly see this in New Zealand, where you guys have done a great job of using fear in your media. Likewise, whenever you see TV anchors, they love to ramp up with anxiousness so that you will not turn the channel. Again, the more TV channels you have, the more this sort of ramps up. But how does this work in social media? And that's actually why fear is so odd and peculiar to make sense of. Sure, we've got plenty of broadcast stuff happening, but what's more powerful is the way that fear is actually being placed into the system in a way that actually people themselves are part of that fear mongering. We've seen an ecosystem where hysteria isn't necessarily coming from on high, but is actually saturated all around us. And this, by the way, is so much more powerful because we think that that fear is coming from people we trust, and we are much more likely to pay attention to that than we are to a political operative. Now, I spend a lot of time with teenagers, and one of the things that I've been fascinated by over the last 8 years is how they've understood the attention economy. And what they've done is ramp up their attempts to try to get their peers' attention. And they use a whole variety of techniques that we would normally think of as social media marketing. Right? They are very attentive to the ability to actually capture people's attention. They use fear, they use drama, they use any sort of emotional pull. And of course, you know, as adults, we sit there and be like, teenagers, why are they doing that? And the odd thing is, we've created that environment where that becomes normative. We've created the environment where the attention economy requires that kind of participation. So again, what does that mean? Now, I want to layer in another concept here, and that is the notion of radical transparency. Because I think radical transparency is part of that dynamic, particularly because it's so relished and valued by the technology community. Now, radical transparency is the notion that putting everything out into the open will make people more honest. It was built into the notion of accountability for corporate actors. The idea was that if you put things out there, you would be a more honest company. But it can also be understood within a social context. In fact, the idea of radical transparency is so heavily relished by the social media community that it is seen as the thing that we should encourage everybody to do. Now, it's interesting to see how this tends to play out, because it often plays out with the idea that we should make those in power be radically transparent. It means making our governments radically transparent. It means valuing transparency from those who are really privileged. But part of it is it rests on the notion that the long-term gains from radical transparency outweigh any personal short-term costs in doing so. Now, the reason I think that radical transparency is weird coming from the tech industry is that we've started to see this twisted on its head. With the rise of Anonymous, the onset of technologically mediated global political movements, and the battles over real names, those in power are actually leveraging the same narratives of radical transparency as a frame to suggest that anonymity and pseudonymity is a social abomination. The idea is that if we force people out into the open, they will behave civilly, where civility is, of course, determined by those in power. We hear this discussed in terms of trolls, and we hear it discussed in terms of things like the Occupy movement. But one of the things I also think is interesting is how this technology gets employed for those agendas itself. So one of the things we've seen in all of the political movements of late is people will take pictures of activists, put it online in order to crowdsource names of who these people are. We are seeing this in Iran, and we're seeing this in Canada. We are seeing this everywhere as a way of the political powers leveraging that attention and leveraging fear. But there's something interesting about the history of this, because in some ways we can understand this in the light of outing, which is a notion we've understood in the LGBT community for a long time. Now, many queer folks have argued that the practice of outing closeted gay people would actually help the movement. It would make people recognize that they knew queer people in their community. But I want to tell you a story of a guy named Oliver Sipple. And Oliver Sipple was a gay man in the 1970s who was not particularly out. He was not particularly open. He was well known within the gay community, but his family didn't know. In 1975, he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place, as one might argue. He was at a situation where the U.S. sitting president, Ford, was present, and a woman tried to assassinate Ford. Now, Sipple was trained in the Marines, and so he made a decision to lunge at this woman, and he was able to push her just as she shot, such that the bullet never hit the president. And he was immediately recognized as a hero, and all of these papers sort of put him up on high and glorified him. Now, a political activist by the name of Harvey Milk, who was extremely well known in San Francisco politics, decided this was a great opportunity for people to understand that gay people could be heroes. So he decided to publicly out Sipple to the media, even though Sipple had specifically asked the media not to discuss his sexuality. The impact on Sipple was devastating. The White House refused to acknowledge him. His family rejected him. He sued the newspaper for invasion of privacy, but his whole life fell apart. He started drinking profusely. He gained about 300 pounds. He became paranoid and suicidal. And he started talking about how he regretted, the number one regret of his life, was his decision to step in and be a hero. He died at the age of 47. Now, did the societal benefits for Milk to out Sipple outweigh the personal consequences for him? This is an extremely hard moral question. Yet this is exactly the question we must ask ourselves when we engage in technologies that encourage radical transparency. We hear this all the time. I mean, radical transparency is in many ways the underpinnings of Facebook these days, right? This idea that we keep shifting the privacy settings so much so that we out people on a regular basis. And I would argue that what happened 2 years ago with those shifts in privacy settings was nothing short of a public outing. It was a public exposure. And many people believe that this is good for society. Indeed, Zuckerberg has argued that this kind of visibility is really important. It will make people more honest. It will make people more civil. It will make people recognize that the world is quite diverse. But the question on the table still remains, is society better off when everyone and everything is publicly out on the open? I'm not sure. Radical transparency is particularly tricky in light of the attention economy because, again, attention economy is not even. That which gets attention is not actually uniform. It's often the things that are most train wreck, most embarrassing, horrific, emotionally devastating. Indeed, those who are marginalized often get more from the attention economy, more from the culture of fear, more from radical transparency. They become the foci in ways that are not necessarily true for those that are privileged. So the cost of radical transparency is actually quite different depending on where you sit within the social ecosystem. Now, radical transparency presumes that outing people will combat fear and increase tolerance. But does it? I genuinely don't know the answer to this. But my hunch is that things aren't working out quite as expected. In the queer community, there was sort of an obsession with the idea that, you know, the last 50 years have been a constant game of progress. We've seen nothing but improvements. But the historian George Chauncey is quick to highlight that actually queer culture has sort of ebbed and flowed over history. And indeed, he argues that prior to World War II, queer folks were actually extraordinarily accepted within society. You would have looked at it and assumed that there was no big issue. And what Chauncey argued is that after Prohibition, what you saw was that the state built a closet in the 1930s and forced gay people into it. Indeed, in Germany in the 1930s, it was an extraordinarily gay time in every sense of the word, but fear very much squelched that. Now, I don't want to get all Godwin's law on you or anything, but it's important to realize that these narratives of progress are not linear. The idea of us building tools and just magically creating enlightenment is not necessarily the outcomes of our well-intended tools. And so we really need to look through that. Now, I'm going to take a moment and position myself in this because it's really hard to have this conversation without recognizing that I share many of the values that you in this room have. And I share them because I come from a certain perspective. I very much identify as a feminist, a third wave feminist. I believe in social liberalism. I'm a geek who's committed to science and the pursuit of knowledge, but I also believe that it's impossible to untether fact from bias, truth from social construct. I respect other people's religious beliefs, but I myself am not religious. All of this shapes my values. All of this shapes my understanding of what progress and enlightenment look like. And I really want to believe that everything we're doing is building towards that environment. Now, tolerance is a good example of something that I'm deeply committed to. I want to see us increase tolerance within society. But we often espouse tolerance as though it's neutral. And it's not. The fact is that people tolerate some things and they don't tolerate other things. We in the geek community have a respect for certain things and not others. Our decisions about what we tolerate stem from our values and our beliefs, our ideas about how the world works. And there are certain people who will embrace difference and what they're exposed to, and there are people who fear it. And it's about that constant contradiction within a broader social environment that challenges our values that we bake into our system. Now, think about this in light of social media. Through network technologies, the tools that we're all building, you are exposed to more things than ever before in history. You have the ability to look online and see into the window of people's lives, people who you don't know. You may not see everything, you may not understand what they're saying, but the idea that you, without ever going to China, can look and read the stories of some Chinese people's lives, the idea that you can read the Tumblr posts of a 16-year-old living in the Netherlands without necessarily encountering them in person, we have the ability to look around the globe and see things. Doesn't mean we do, but we have that ability. Now, this is a really interesting challenge because, you know, how do we understand this as explorers? In many ways, we're creating technologies that allow for a radical new kinds of exploration around the world. But how do you make of this opportunity? It's important to realize that historically, when explorers traveled the world looking for opportunities because of the new technologies that were built at those day and ages, they weren't really tolerant of other populations. They pretty much pillaged and plundered, looking for riches in any way possible. Fear ruled the seas. And let's be honest, exposure to other people during the days of great exploration did not magically produce tolerance. It bred anger, distrust, and hatred that we're very much living with us today. So why do we think that the tools that we're building for a new kind of to be used in any different way? Indeed, I would argue that they're being used for economic purposes in order to pillage and plunder. They're being used to fear other people. And I'm always amazed at the polarization that can happen online. The internet makes visible things to us that we like to see, but it also makes visible to us things that we don't understand and things that we hate and things that we fear. And it's this constant intersection that is part of where the culture of fear comes from. Now, consider some of the moral panics that I deal with all the time. My favorite right now, everyone is tittering about the idea of cyberbullying. Cyberbullying is an obsession. And every day I wake up to news reports about how cyberbullying is increasing, and it's a plague upon society, and we need to stop the cyberbullying. And I find this really fascinating, because bullying is one of the few spaces where we have tremendous data over decades. And the interesting thing is that bullying is not on the rise. In fact, during the whole period in which we saw the rise of the internet, we saw no rise of bullying. It's kind of odd to think about. So what is that disconnect between what we see in the data and what we perceive? If your child came home beaten up, right, with a black eye, you would know that something was going on. But if they came home sort of grumpy and unhappy, you wouldn't necessarily know. What's happened is that the online environment means that when we see bullying, it's much more visible to us and to adults than ever before in history. Young people consistently report that cyberbullying is not actually the major concern in their lives. They report that bullying in person at schools happens more frequently, with higher emotional distress, and with greater personal impact in all sorts of ways. So what is it about this disconnect? How do we understand cyber? And it really comes down to that issues of perception and the issues of visibility. The scale of the visibility spins our own fears and anxieties out of control. It means that when we see young people online engaging in negative acts, we imagine the worst. And indeed, one of the other things that becomes frustrating about cyberbullying is that parents overreact to almost everything. This doesn't mean that there's not serious bullying online. There is, and we need to combat it. But building up a fear-mongering, telling us that it's everywhere, saying that it's radically on the rise, doesn't help the young people, especially those who are actually facing it every day in school. Now, we've seen these kinds of dynamics before. When my mother was growing up, her parents heard about the terrible things that were happening from other parents, and their fear was very much driven by word-of-mouth messaging. Now, when I was growing up, it was very much about what was in the news, and my mother was always paying attention to the media to understand what she should fear as a parent. What's funny is that in today's environment, it becomes very networked, and such that people listen to what spreads across the internet. And what spreads across the internet is inevitably the most fearful. So again, you trust it because you heard it from a friend. And I hear this from young people all the time. When I was interviewing young people about sexual predators, they would be like, sexual predators were gonna come out and haunt them and eat them and do terrible, terrible things to them. And I was like, did you know anybody who was harmed by a sexual predator? Oh, no. But I heard from so-and-so, from so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so that it happened to this person. And you're like, okay. And where did so-and-so and so-and-so hear it? And I slowly worked out that basically everything came back to a news story. And I start to realize that we perceive it to be very close to us. We perceive it to be in our faces all the time when we hear it through network media. Now, this is something that we actually leverage all the time. And one of the other frustrating parts about my job these days is that I'm dealing with the idea that protect the kids becomes justification for regulating the internet in any way you could possibly imagine. And I dealt with this a few years back when I naively thought that people actually wanted to protect the kids. So I was commissioned by the U.S. Attorneys General to go and figure out what was happening in terms of online safety. And I really failed to read the code of what they wanted, so I went and produced a report about all of the victimization of young people and all the places where we could actually make a difference. And the pictures were really powerful and consistent. The data was really strong. I was really excited. So I turned this over, explaining how sexual predation works, to the U.S. Attorneys General, and a man named Blumenthal, who was at the time one of the Attorneys General, he looked at me and said, go find different data. I was like, okay, that's not going to work out so well because this data is pretty consistent. And he's like, I need data because this is about age verification technologies. I was like, no, age verification technologies are not going to solve your problem. And he was just like, it will. And so for the next month, he spent time in the press basically turning me into a pariah, telling the press how terrible I was, undermining all of our data. And I was like, oh, this is about politics, isn't it? Over the last couple of years, I've seen this ramped up, and I'm watching this take form increasingly with laws that we're seeing regulate the internet. I just spent time in Canberra in Australia. I'm going to talk to some folks here. I'm amazed at how regulators across the world are using fear and their genuine belief in fear to regulate the technologies that we love. So this is where I want to talk about our little pretty geek bubble. We live in a wonderful internet bubble. It's this exact bubble that is why I came online in the first place. I was so excited to be a part of this. I grew up in Usenet and IRC. It was so refreshing to be a part of something that was different than my everyday life. I wanted it to be separate. And indeed, many of the people that I encountered really embraced the idea that the internet would be a transformative space. You know, I would hear the words of Stuart Brand and I was enamored. I don't know how many of you remember John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. This was all about the potential and positiveness of the tools we were created. And the funny thing is that many people believed that when this went and became mainstream, that there would be some form of magical enlightenment. And indeed, I've been most entertained by watching Jaron Lanier go from serious utopianism in the 1990s to serious dystopianism these days, because the technologies did become mainstream, but they did not have magical enlightenment. In fact, as these tools went mainstream, they were used for mainstream things, good, bad, and ugly. And that isn't necessarily the enlightenment that many of us hoped for. Of course, the Arab Spring has brought back similar kinds of rhetorics to 1995, the idea of this magical transformation, what was all going to be possible. I can't tell you how exhausting it was to hear about the social media revolutions, right? As the sort of technology, it's going to bring democracy to the globe, it's going to do all these wonderful things. Now, Egypt is a really fascinating case study. It's a fascinating case study because it's more than meets the eye. Indeed, there was civil unrest in an environment because of economic conditions, a whole set of frustrations over what it meant to deal with corrupt politics. And there was indeed an amazing, powerful group of people who leveraged social media to inform one another and to be part of something. There were also people who showed up in Tahrir, who should never be ignored, because the idea of being able to bring people out was really important. Now, as people turn to social media, it's important to realize that those voices became the voices that got propagated around the globe. Those voices were inevitably pro-democratic. They were inevitably English-speaking or could communicate with English audiences by making arguments that were relevant to English audiences. And it was really about what kind of stories could get magnified by mainstream media, including Al Jazeera. Right? So the stories that we saw spreading were of a particular narrow crowd in Egypt. Right? Now, that doesn't mean that that crowd wasn't really relevant and really important. It was. But let's acknowledge that Egypt is a much larger country than those that we could see through social media. And indeed, you know, millions of people never turned out, never participated in Tahrir, never participated online. And so as we talked about democracy, in many ways, those people got written out. And those people were very much thinking about survival and about their communities and their home environments. And so we started to get this really conflicting narrative of what was happening in the Arab Spring. And I think nowhere was this more confronting and confusing than during the elections, where I was shocked how many people were surprised that the Muslim Brotherhood won in the elections. Because the thing is that as social media was leveraged to broadcast a certain message out into the globe writ large, the Muslim Brotherhood was doing a phenomenal job of working networks within actual communities, people who weren't online, and they were finding ways to actually network the population. They ended up controlling how information flowed within those communities. And indeed, in an environment where you just assume corruption and you're just trying to weigh between different kinds of corruption, why would you believe the rhetoric of the mainstream media? You're not going to necessarily. I should say that I note this as an American who recognizes that her own political system is about as corrupt as it can get. So I'm not saying this in any judgmental way. I actually think my government is far worse than this. But I think it's important to recognize that this is part of the politics at stake. Now, in geek communities, we've talked a lot about Eli Pariser's filter bubble, which is a phenomenal book at looking at how algorithms filter the world for us so that we see a world just like us. The challenge is that we've already been doing this. We do this by the networks that we're connected to. The networks of people like us, the notion of homophily, are extremely powerful. Breaking out of those networks is extremely hard. And I think one of the reasons why the filter bubble becomes such a strong argument is that we are used to a mainstream narrative from mainstream press combating those homophily issues. And that is really falling apart in these environments. But it's important to realize that through all of these systems and the tools that we're building, a lot of it is about how networks are coming together and the power that operates there. There's a sociologist named Manuel Castells, and he argues that technology continues to rupture power, and indeed, this is a lot of what we get really excited by. He then continues on to argue that power does an amazing job of trying to embrace that technology to find a way to build out power itself. Power is no longer hierarchical. It's very much about networks. It's about having power within networks, the networks that we are building. Those who control the information, those who can control how information flows and to whom, those are some of the most powerful actors in our society. Now, only characters that are more powerful are those who can build the networks. And interestingly, more often than not, that is becoming us. Not only are we building the networks of how people can connect, but we are also building the networks upon which people themselves can build the networks. And so the tools that we're building are not actually neutral, and they're not actually just simply being out there and look, magical things happen. But indeed, all of our values, all of our ideologies, and all of our systems are biasing how these work out. Right? So how do we think about these technologies? Now, in a broadcast environment, propagating fear was really about propagating broadcast messages. We are still living in that fear-mongering. It hasn't gone away. But the more insidious form of fear-mongering is emerging from that which appears to come from the grassroots. It's that from which comes from within the networks that we build and the networks of people that are built on top of the networks that we build. It's this kind of fear-mongering that often gets narrated as being about social norms. How do we understand the social norms that get generated by the systems that we build? I would argue that it's extremely imperative that we understand our role within this power ecosystem, not just as a radicalizer, not just as an enthusiast to say we can actually transform society in beautiful ways, but that we have responsibilities. Because the technologies that we're building are very much shaping public life. We are no longer just building tools for geeks. We're no longer just building tools that are for our friends that we can actually make sense of. And in fact, we don't even have the time to see the tools that we make play out comfortably within society. More often than not, they move so fast, and the tools that get out there go so far that we don't often even know what's happening there. Now, one of the things I love about geek culture is I love how geeks really want to envision an awesome world, and we really want to drive towards that. And I think this is extremely important. This is core to innovation. But we also have to recognize our own power, and we have to recognize how our decisions really shape the cultures that we're creating. So what is the design agenda for the complex systems that we're creating here? Now, I'm not suggesting that you can configure the users. You can't tell them how to behave. But every decision that you make as a designer sets in motion a set of ideas and a set of dynamics. How do you make sure that you're watching what's playing out? And how do you design with a world that is far more complicated than you? A world that is very much about power and control? A world where people in the mainstream will use our tools to actually do things that are not necessarily things that we're excited by. We are ramping up the attention economy through the tools we're building. We're setting in motion all sorts of new networks. We like to think of ourselves as disrupting power, because indeed that was what geek culture was about for so long. One of the things that's weird is that power is now coming back and employing the technologies we've built. The status quo is now leveraging these environments. And indeed, some of us are really excited by $100 billion valuations, right? It seems as though we've suddenly become legitimized. It's okay, we're now part of the elite. But I would argue that we should go back to our geek core and question, what are the kinds of assumptions that we see in the society as we look around? How can we disrupt it? And are we okay with it? And it's a really hard challenge, because I don't know that there's a really good answer to it. I don't think that many of us actually even understand what's playing out. So my invitation to you as designers, as technologists, as users, as entrepreneurs, is to really start critically engaging in a world beyond this geek environment, and to see not just how 2 degrees off is using the tools you've built, but to really get inside the systems and see all of the possibilities of how this plays out by those who are powerful and by those who are not. Thank you very much.
Dana Boyd, an internet researcher at Harvard and Microsoft, speaking recently at the Webstock 12 conference. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, and now we hear Kerosene Records' digitally distributed parody of Stephen Sondheim's West Side Story. The song is based on the New York City Police Department's new white shirt avatar, Inspector Edward Wimsky, who succeeds former Occupy Commander Tony Baloney, who famously maced and kettled women during the early days of the Occupy Wall Street protests.
Hey, you!
Who, me, Officer Wimsky?
Yeah, you! Give me one good reason for not dragging you down to 100 Center Street, you punk!
Dear kindly Captain Wimsky, you gotta understand, the economy just stinkskis, our future's in the can. The world is on the brinkski, and hope's in short supply. Golly, Bloomberg, that's why we occupy.
Gee, Officer Wimsky, please put down your mace. Your checks are paid by citizens, you punch in the face. Your pension's been stolen and nobody cares. Deep down inside we know you're scared.
You are scared!
You are scared, you are scared. We know you're just scared. We know that you're angry 'cause you're scared.
That's a touching good story.
Let me tweet it to the world.
Just tell it to the judge.
Dear kindly judge, your honor, the laws don't make no sense. Jail for marijuana at the citizens' expense. But the criminals on Wall Street are getting off scot-free. Leapin', Lehman, they crash the economy.
Right!
Officer Wimsky, the laws are unjust. You can't arrest us all, soon there'll be no one to bust. The charges are trumped up, they'll all be dismissed. That's why the people are so upset.
We are upset.
We are upset. We are upset. We are really upset. We're the 99% and we are upset.
In the opinion of this court, this activist is depraved on account he ain't had a decent education.
Hey, I'm depraved on account I'm deprived.
So send him to college. You.
My School is too expensive. The debt is out of hand. The loan sharks are oppressive, but I'm doing all I can to get some real employment. I need a real degree. Goodness, grad school costs too much for me.
Yes, Officer Winsky, the boy has been robbed. He finished school in debt and now he can't find a job. Society told him that this was the way, but now he has bills that he can't pay.
I can't pay!
We can't pay. No, we cannot pay like we can. Find work so we can't pay.
In my opinion, this kid don't need to go to college at all. Poverty is purely a social disease.
Hey, I got a social disease.
So take him to a social worker.
Dear kindly social worker, they say go earn a buck. Like be a coffee perker, which means I'll be a schmuck. But even Starbucks coffee wants employment history. Glory Trotsky, so they won't hire me.
Eek, Officer Winsky, we know you're annoyed. But pretty soon even you will be unemployed. There's work down at Walmart if you'll man the door. So type your resume and join the poor.
I am poor!
We are poor, we are too damn poor. There's no hope for us because we're poor.
The trouble is on Wall Street.
The trouble is the war.
The trouble is the mayor doesn't care about the poor.
The trouble is Monsanto.
The trouble is worldwide.
Winsky, all our grievances are tied. G, Officer Winsky, who do you represent? The only folks you're serving are the damn 1%. G, Officer Winsky, what are we to do?
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson and produced with Thiago Grosso. We welcome your comments at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.